Ankara is calling on Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Iran, describing them as a desire shared by other Arab states. Germany is expected to extend and tighten COVID lockdown measures until mid-February as fears grow over a more contagious COVID variant. And also in the headline, China is saying it opposes the U.S. suppressing its companies. President Donald Trump has ordered an assessment of security risks from Chinese drones. This is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with our top story, Qatar calling on Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Iran to resolve any dispute. Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani says that he's hopeful such talks will happen. He says this is also a desire that is shared by other members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council. The top Qatari diplomat says his country will facilitate the negotiations if asked by stakeholders. Last month, GCC members Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE re-established diplomatic ties with Qatar after breaking them off in June 2017. The trio broke ties at that time partly because of Qatar's relations with Iran. Tehran has repeatedly said it's open to any initiative that would help ease tensions in the Persian Gulf region. A political commentator, Laith Maruf, says that Qatar is trying to revive its mediating role to support imperial interests in the region as a new U.S. president is set to enter the White House.
So Qatar is returning to its original role that was there 5 years ago before Trump came into power, which is to play this hidden role of providing support for imperial positions in the region under the guise of supposed democracy and representation. So Iran has to be very careful from engaging in something like this and wasting another 5-6 years of negotiation with the U.S. while the United States gets to rearrange its forces in the region to confront the axis of resistance.
Phase two of large-scale maneuvers by the ground force of the Iran army has been conducted south of the country. The drill saw special forces successfully carry out joint airborne and combat operations. The exercises also involved divers who landed on the sea and submerged deep down to destroy the projected targets. They then made it onto the shore and hit enemy targets there. The drills also included electronic warfare, that's operations to jam the enemy's command control systems. Early on Tuesday, the Army conducted phase one of the maneuvers. During the drills, domestically developed tactics were deployed to boost rapid reaction troops' preparedness to break into enemy lines.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtidar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games is to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the rapid reaction forces and corps and the mobile offense units of the Army ground forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we staged these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Humana Abedi, Jost.
Time now for the news review section. Stay with us. Welcome to the news review. Iran ambassador to the United Nations has called on all signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to uphold their end of the bargain. Majid Taklavanchi pointed to U.S. obligations under the International Accord and U.N. Resolution 2231, which endorsed the agreement. He said not only the U.S., but the European parties must also respect their commitments under the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The Iranian diplomat says that the administration of President-elect Joe Biden must lift all sanctions mentioned in Resolution 2231.
Over the past few years, the U.S. has changed the name of some of the sanctions that were lifted under the JCPOA. For example, it has renamed the sanctions imposed on Iran's central bank. This is not our problem. It's up to the Americans to solve their problems. It's unacceptable for us to hear them say, we will comply with the JCPOA, but we won't lift these sanctions because they have been recategorized.
Well, the Iranian official also said that his country will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the deal once all the other parties do the same. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. In return, Tehran announced the gradual scaling back of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Let's now discuss this a little bit and see what our guests think about it. I'll have Polina Veronis, political commentator and analyst, joining us from Paphos, Cyprus, and also Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. Good to have you with us. Welcome to the show. Let's go to Cyprus first. Polina, Tehran says lift the sanctions in the first place, stick to UN Resolution 2231, and then you can talk about any other thing. What's your opinion?
Well, actually, it was expected from the side of Iran, but actually, Imam Khamenei has said many times that if we go to the table of negotiations, we need to have an issue to negotiate. And from the first place, as we have the sanctions, the United States, they don't want to change their position. There are not many things to be discussed. So United States are called all the legal representations and the international laws or the human resources, from the human rights in order to sit on a table and, have it by a bilateral negotiation, bilateral agreement about the sanctions. And, of course, we discuss about sanctions that they are illegal. It's not that Iran is doing a favor to the to United States to sit on the table, but from the other side, we call it country that is a postage of sanctions, illegal sanctions for so many years, and we call Iran to sit on the table to negotiate. But from the other side, from the side of the United States, at least, there is no reason to be negotiated at the moment that they don't come and they don't make an offer to the international community, to change and apply the laws as they are. So we would expect this position from Iran. It's something that Imam Khamenei said many times. It's something like the government of Mr. Rouhani applied. But from the other side, we see that United States, they have to come, they have to make offer of peace to international community. And for first time in the history, after so many wars, with so many abuse of the international laws, many times in their recent history, to be consistent with the international laws, sit on the table, and in any case, withdraw from the sanctions, not from the agreement as they've done illegally also in 2018, but withdraw, I mean, for the first time in their history, from the sanctions that they are applied to Iran.
Okay, let's go to Bristol. Tony, how do you look at this? Because, you know, Iran waited for more than a year after President Trump withdrew his country from the JCPOA, and then he reimposed the sanctions unilaterally. So, yeah, go ahead, please.
What bothers me most about this is the way that the United States has shown clearly to anybody watching, which is not the Western mainstream press, because they never watch in any great detail. They just parrot what the embassies, the Foreign Office, and the State Department say on these issues, is the way that they have changed, for example, certain parts of the sanctions. They've just renamed them and called them something else in order to try and dodge actually what their commitments were in the original deal. And then they come and they say, well, we haven't broken that agreement. Well, of course they have. They've got a bunch of barrack room lawyers trying desperately to wriggle out of the things they've agreed to, and then they pretend to the world that they haven't agreed to them. So they're really insulting the whole world, and particularly the world's diplomatic and legal community, by trying to wriggle out in this fashion. It's a similar way, in fact, as we've seen some Zionists do. What I mean, for example, one of the things the Bible says is you mustn't keep pigs on the land. So what they do is they create these kind of elevated wooden sections and keep the pigs on there instead. It's not the same exactly, but you can see what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. Is they're just twisting the law in order to suit themselves. With the JCPOA, what's at stake here is nothing less than, I think, a potential third world war, because you've already got the Russians in the region. If the Israelis kick off in Jerusalem, for example, against the Al-Aqsa Mosque, just as one example, one place they could, you know, you're going to then have the Americans dragged into a potential conflict down there. The Palestinians, who are virtually defenseless, have been stripped of all their rights and all their dignity involved. And the trouble is, if you get the US and Russia in the same region getting embroiled in a conflict, and of course the Israelis know this, they're playing a brinksmanship game. You eventually will get China dragged in too. So this could eventually lead to anything up to and including a third world war. That's why the JCPOA is so important. And the question to ask Biden is, are you serious about actually rejoining this? Because the question seems to be often, isn't it, in American elections and many elections here in the West, where we get all these promises beforehand and then it all changes after. So is he going to rejoin? I mean, we've already heard just this week in the Jerusalem Post that Netanyahu is trying to derail Biden's attempt to rejoin the JCPOA. So whilst many Biden and many of his supporters, the people who voted for him, might very much want to, I think it's potentially going to happen that Biden is leveraged by the enormous Israeli lobby in the US not to do it. Let's hope and pray that they do, because this JCPOA is as vital, as I've said, to prevent a third world war.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Now, Paulina, you said that the U.S. should return to the JCPOA, known as the Iran nuclear deal. How can Iran be rest assured that it's not going to withdraw again? Because Iran, this is a multilateral accord, right? And U.S. being one of the signatories. And this is what President Trump did. How can we make sure that President Biden wouldn't do the same thing?
When we talk about international law, unfortunately, there are no guarantees about what's going to happen in the international agreement. Of course, there are provisions, and there are provisions, for example, in this agreement as well, that Iran can ask for compensation for its damages, losses, direct and indirect losses, as we say in the legal terms. But, for example, I am a lawyer, I am an international law lawyer, but in any case, even if we go to court, we can have some compensation. We can go and say that we have statutory provisions that they've been abused by United States. So from the legal part, nothing can prohibit United States from withdrawal, because, I mean, we know that Iran is not going to take any war action against the United States. From the other side, we see that Biden is up to date and up to its declarations to what point this wants to take its hegemony, United States hegemony in Middle East. We say at the point that the United States are declining in the region, that's why we have Israel that is looking for new collaboration. Actually, it doesn't normalize, but it's making official its relationship that keeps with the monarchies in the region since 1980. So United States, they cannot really support their presence in the region. From my side, I believe that Biden is going to sit on the table, but in a very reluctant way, which means that he's not going to say, I'm coming back to the agreement, but I want to have some official meetings with the diplomats of the Islamic Republic. So probably they are going to have some pre-negotiations. They are going to introduce themselves as well. And actually, it is to the benefit of the United States to act in a very calm way towards Iran, because we see at the moment that their power is declining. Russia and China, they are becoming very, very demanding in their region. So I don't see that even if they enter, if they withdraw, Iran is going to have sufficient in profit, or is going to have sufficient damages from.
Right.
I mean, what we have seen now is that. I would like to mention something that my counter speaker said about the third war. I don't want you not to panic the people. We don't talk about any third war. We don't have any evidences to talk about any kind of war in the region. We talk about countries that, they assess their power, and all the countries, they assess how powerful is Iran, and it's the most powerful country in the Middle East at the moment. So let's don't panic the people.
Okay.
There is no third war. There is no war at all from my side.
Okay, Tony, if you want to have your reaction, go ahead. We have 1 minute.
Quickly, I think people were saying this in 1939. Nobody would do this. Nobody wants war. I'm afraid there are people out there, a tiny, tiny minority, the 0.01%, that do want war. They make money from war, and I'm afraid they also gain political capital and finance from the outcome of a war. So in other words, we're talking here about creating the chaos, and then actually, you know, Naomi Klein has written about this in Disaster Capitalism. She's explained very well that there is a tiny, tiny number of people who gain massively from conflict and from even mass death of humanity. They can still make money at this. And so those are the people I think we need to put in jail before this is allowed to get going. But I wouldn't discount the possibility of war. We've seen it before. And although I'm not trying not to scaremonger, I think it's just so important to point out how important this JCPOA is, and how important it is for the European powers to make sure the Americans are not allowed to derail it, no matter what Benjamin Netanyahu tries to do in Washington.
Okay, let's hope a war would never happen again. Thank you very much for your contribution. Paulina Avranos, a political commentator, analyst, joined us from Paphos, Cyprus, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol, with their comments and contribution. Thank you for staying tuned. The German government mulls extending and tightening a partial lockdown in the country amid growing fears of the spread of more contagious coronavirus variant. Chancellor Angela Merkel and regional leaders are likely to agree on a two-week extension of a nationwide lockdown that's set to expire by the end of the month. In a draft resolution, the government has reportedly proposed further restrictive measures in public and more aid for companies. Officials saying the existing lockdowns have already lowered infection rates. The new protocols are aimed at controlling new COVID strains that have been found in many countries. Germany has reported more than 47,000 coronavirus-related deaths and over 2 million confirmed cases. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC,
Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The Limelight.
A new report found that senior U.S. administration officials were fully aware that the zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New IG Report Finds Proof of Trump Team Cruelty to Asylum Seekers. Here's the details of this article. As a former leading U.S. Justice Department official recently said, he regretted the role he played in the Trump administration's zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy in the wake of a scathing Inspector General report. Human and civil rights groups pointed to the probe's findings as damning proof of the administration's cruelty toward people seeking refuge in the United States. The Inspector General's report concluded that President Donald Trump, ex-Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and other senior officials were woefully unprepared when U.S. agents started seizing thousands of migrant children from their asylum-seeking parents and relatives who were often imprisoned in concentration camps after entering the United States. First, in a 2017 DOJ pilot program and then nationwide the following year. The report, based on interviews with dozens of DOJ officials and a review of over 200,000 emails and other electronic files, directly implicates Trump in the disastrous policy. It also found that senior administration officials were fully aware that the policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. In response to the report, former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein released recently a statement of regret. Since leaving the department, I have often asked myself what we should have done differently, and no issue has dominated my thinking more than the zero-tolerance immigration policy, Rosenstein told NBC News. It was a failed policy that never should have been proposed or implemented. I wish we all had done better. The ACLU, which successfully sued to block family separation and immediately reunite families, led human and civil rights groups in reacting to what it called the damning report. The barbaric family separation practice was immoral and illegal, said Lee Glurant, the ACLU lawyer who led the family separation suit, in a statement recently. This new report shows just how far the Trump administration was willing to go to destroy these families. Just when you think the Trump administration can't sink any lower, it does. The new DOJ report's findings correspond with those of a 21-month House Judiciary Committee investigation published last October that accused the Trump administration of reckless incompetence and intentional cruelty in its implementation of the zero-tolerance policy. In November, Common Dreams reported that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of five, when they were ripped away from their parents, remained separated from their families. As a result of the separation policy, both parents and children, who were often told by U.S. officials that they would never see each other again, have suffered tremendous emotional and psychological trauma that Physicians for Human Rights has called torture and state-sanctioned child abuse. Some of the CIS children have been placed in U.S. families, who are sometimes able to petition for permanent custody, and it is feared that some of the children may indeed never see their parents again. In late June 2018, as public outrage mounted in the face of stories like a breastfeeding baby being torn away from her mother and a father driven to suicide after being separated from his wife and child, the administration reluctantly rolled back the policy, which, along with forced surgical removal of reproductive organs of migrant women, has been called the Trump administration's worst domestic human rights violation. During the 2020 election, Joe Biden vowed to form a task force to reunite all of the separated children with their relatives. Glurant stressed that he must now follow through on his promise. The Biden-Harris administration will inherit the legacy of family separation, and we don't doubt that more horrific details will continue to emerge, the ACLU attorney said. We need them to act with urgency. Every day without action makes it harder to find and reunite families. The incoming administration must reunite the separate families in the United States, but we cannot stop there, Glurant added. These families deserve citizenship, resources, care, and a commitment that family separation will never happen again.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochrane, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
The game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist, controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest liar, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed. I revel in your hatred. Because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one. Oh, so it just gave me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I've never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but been involved in countless campaigns, but also we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So
years in the making.
Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse. I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure. And you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This what was so useful about this film was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say, this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It's a key strategy of Nixon, and we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which I had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that. That whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right-wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized. And it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies, he wants to cut corporation tax to record lows, roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it is absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, with denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is the rolling back of state intervention.
And he knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But surely that would discredit
Trump. He's
yes.
part of this, and it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
that is a very interesting point. And Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying. The clip with Roger Stone where he said NBC's the CNN, actually, they're marginalized now, the Breitbart and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but are becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme center. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that, the work of momentum, combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going
to
win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.